Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, I'm so delighted you're joining me this evening. We're going to be talking with a woman who is very committed to bringing forth the understanding of how we can personally empower ourselves. When you look at what's going on in the world today, you may feel that, oh, everything is just absolutely such a mucky mess. Are we ever going to be able to get out of it? And we get so engaged with our, what I want to say, our biases and what often is given to us via media and so many other sources of information via the internet, etc., that really are not giving us what we need to know so that we can ask, number one, for the facts, but also be aware that we have more power as an individual than we could even imagine. I want to welcome to the show Reverend Marilyn Redman. And she has quite a background here. But I will say that she has come out with this book, A Spark of Truth. And her background and her life story, I think, is extremely interesting because it was a journey for her to learn how to overcome a lot of what would be considered by obstacles, big obstacles by any one of us hearing her story. And I think it's going to make you aware of the fact that life is a wonderful gift. But more than that, you are in charge of really how you can make that life turn out in a positive way, believe it or not. Dr. Marilyn Redman, welcome to the show.
I'm so glad to be here, Donna. Thank you for having me on your show. This is such a special day.
Well, you know what, Marilyn? I really feel that, and going through your book, A Spark of Truth, I so appreciated your integrity about your own personal story. It's not easy to sit down and to, you might say, bare the soul of, you know, what you go through. And there are so many of us that will say, I don't want anybody to know about my dirty laundry. But you just put it right out there. And obviously, that's because you learned how to use the right kind of detergent, mental detergent, to scrub up what would have been considered a sense of shame or whatever other descriptive adjective we might want to put to whatever it is we go through. And you say, thank you, I'm hanging it out to dry, and it's going to be sparkling white and clean, and I don't give a hoot what anybody else thinks. Congratulations. Not many people do that.
Well, thank you for the accolade. That's very kind of you.
When you started on your journey, it was not because your life was perfect. It was far from it. But you really got hit by, I would say, not just 10 by 4s by the universe. You got hit with 20 by 20s. And
well, it's been overwhelming at times, believe me.
Oh, I can imagine. And having been through a few episodes like that myself, I go, madam, you really did a good job here. Give us a little bit of background about what you went through and what it took to finally make you say, this isn't going to work anymore.
Well, I have described it in some of my other books besides The Spark of Truth. My story starts way back when I was a child. I was raised in domestic violence. My parents were mentally ill, and my father was an alcoholic, and my stepdad and mother were mentally ill. I never knew what reality was. I didn't know what love was, even though I was in Sunday school and church for 50 years. I was shut down emotionally because of all the abuse I went through in that childhood. And then when I married I thought I was going to create a happy family that was going to get along and everybody was going to have a good time. And I married what I was used to, so I just extended all the abusive things from the past and discovered I'd married just exactly what I came from, which is alcoholism, mental illness. He was a psychopath and a sex addict, and I'd been sexually abused earlier, so that attracted that situation. And he was a rageaholic, and my stepdad was a rageaholic. So I definitely had put myself in the same predicament and didn't even know it in those days. And it wasn't until life got so severe, he was threatening to kill me. And several times, I've almost died 13 times. And in this particular situation, after 30 years of marriage of all this domestic violence and abuse, I was in a car ride coming home from Canada. We had been on vacation, and he got real lividly upset that night before we left. And so he was so upset we ended up leaving in the middle of the night, driving home, and he was going to kill us in the car. And so I had always read prayers from the hymnal at church. I never knew that you could make up your own prayers in those days. And all of a sudden, spontaneously, I called inside nice and loudly, "God, please help me. I really don't want to die." We'd had three situations where I thought for sure we were goners in the car ride. And fortunately, within minutes, he was off the road, passed out over the wheel. And one thing led to another. I'll make a long story short. I ended up coming home. My son had to come and get me because I asked for the police to take me out of the car. I'd left a note at a coffee shop for help. And so I came home and had a restraining order, divorce papers ready. But I couldn't go through with the divorce for three tries because I was so codependent. And I couldn't understand what, but I didn't realize I was also emotionally 3 years old, and I never grew up from seeing my real dad beat my mother when I was 3 years old, and I went into a turtle shell to protect myself emotionally. So I'm operating as a three-year-old during this situation, and wondering how I'm going to get out of this marriage. And it was a real difficult time, and it took tons of courage to finally go through with the divorce, be on my own. I went to a psychiatrist for help because of the anxiety, and he gave me Valium. Now, in the 70s, there was a saying that when women went for help, they had a Valium deficiency, which, of course, I didn't have a Valium deficiency, and I got addicted to it. So because of the addiction to Valium, and I was, in those days, a social drinker, but I found out at treatment that one pill and one drink is six times the effect chemically in your system. So I got addicted. And in treatment, they gave me a spiritual program to follow, which is called the 12 Steps. And they had us meditating every morning, which in my church had preached against meditation. So that was a very big step. I never knew about faith and taking a leap of faith, but to learn to meditate was a huge leap of faith. However, it has been the best solution to all my problems, because today, through my meditations, I can connect with the answers that work for me from my heart. Instead of living off the fear in my head and releasing all of that, let go of it, replace it with the love of the universe that created me, I can now live in a life where I am thoroughly loved and appreciate it, can take it in, and have a reality in my life today. Love is reality, and I didn't live in reality until I found meditation and a higher power that loved me and gave me that courage inside and gave me that power back to myself instead of giving it to somebody else. What I found out is when you look outside for advice and authority or someone telling you how you should do it, you're actually giving them the power over you. And today I don't look for for advice from others. I listen to my heart, and in my heart is a piece of God, P-I-E-C-E. My soul is a piece of God, and I have the power. I just didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I feel I know I had to learn about, and it is getting rid of the indoctrinations of experience like you went through. And it wasn't a simple journey. It was years of your life. And yet you're a very, very educated woman. You have, you know, even in school as a young person, you were a valedictorian of your class. I mean, here you are going through all of these experiences, and someone listening to this might say, oh, I can relate to it, but life is not fair. This is not fair. This shouldn't be happening to me. And playing out a role of victim, and I'm not saying this to criticize people, and because it is something that's very human. We all do it in one form or one type or another. And I really think that to wake up, to really be aware of ourselves, that does take courage, because so often our environments that we're in want us to stay right in the box that it's created for us. And for us to step out of that box, we have to be willing to kick the door down. You were willing to kick the door down, weren't you?
Well, it was a matter of life or death in my case, because when I was in treatment, they told me I was dying. And what, because the pill, the combination of the medication with alcohol was killing me, and I was in the last stages of alcoholism, and to pick up a drink or to take any mind or mood altering medications, I would, you know, be I would die. So it was a matter of a decision out of, do I want to live or do I want to die? And I really know today I came to help people learn that they can overcome these situations too, and I had to go through them and come out on the other side to have the wisdom and experience. And so in my counseling and in my writing, and when I do a lot of pro bono work and a lot of volunteer work, and when I'm helping people, and it's the sharing of your experience that's the healing. So when somebody goes for counseling, if the person that's doing the counseling has had the experience, you will get results. If somebody is just still in their head trip, it's just words. Mm-hmm. There's something about sharing from the heart and sharing the truth about a situation that's very healing. And the energy and the courage inside grows, and you feel better about yourself. You feel like you can do it, where before you didn't feel like you had the ability to do it. Today, I love being able to help people because it helps me.
Yes, and you did I'll call it an exercise. You called it, I believe, a ritual in your book. You had so much anger that was inside of you, and you had been married to someone that was a rageaholic, to put it bluntly, and there are many people that go through that. But you were able, with the use of balloons, to release that anger. Tell us what you did.
Well, over the years, I've gotten a little smarter, let's put it that way. I found out that when people, there's only two emotions, well, there's energy, positive and negative. And if people have had a really difficult life and experience and they're in fear, they're very angry. My ex-husband had a terribly abusive childhood. He told me what it was one time. He was full of anger. Well, I didn't even know I was full of anger because of my abuse. It was so, I shut it off. And the pills, the medications, I found out stop your feelings just like alcohol does. So what I found out is that when you get sober or get clean from any toxic substances, you can start having feelings. And what I realized is that when I'm angry, it's because somebody wasn't doing what I wanted. Things didn't go my way. Things didn't happen the way I thought they should. And so my anger was from my disappointments. And today I know everything went the way exactly it was supposed to go for my growing and learning. And what I learned about my husband is his anger was from his abusive childhood, and it was his anger, not mine. And everybody comes into this planet wounded in some way. And so when we come from fear, we stay in that woundedness, and we express it as anger. So I detached, and it's his anger today. And what happened in the past is history, so I don't have to hang on to it. I don't have to keep carrying his anger or my anger today. I can live in the present. So instead of having one foot in the past and one foot in the work, my mother taught me worry very well because she went through the Great Depression. And so I was never living in the moment. And if I'm living in the moment, it's a gift, and it's called the present. And when I'm in that presence of my higher power, my creator, there's peace and love and comfort, and my needs are met. Life is okay right now. All things are going well. Life is good. And so I give up the anger. I let it go because it's history, and it doesn't have to influence me anymore.
With the balloons, you did something that I thought was very significant. Anyone and everything or everyone that you would find yourself getting angry about, you would write their name on the balloon and then release it.
Well, I was taught to do that. I can't remember when, but I happened to fortunately live near a dollar store. And of course, they're not dollar stores now. And could go up to the store, get myself some balloons with helium, and I'd write the name of the person on the balloon and let it go. So not only did I mentally let it go because I don't have to stay in the past anymore, but it was a symbolic release of the emotions to that attachment in that person that was causing trouble for me. So I just released the balloon and let it fly away into the ethers until I couldn't see it anymore, and I felt free. It was a very freeing act.
Also in your book, and you've got so many different subjects that you cover in this book, A Spark of Truth, and in our time together, we obviously are going to be able to discuss all of them. But one of the aspects you bring out, which I think is very, very significant, and you related this also with children, and that is nutrition and how important it is to be aware that we have to pay attention to that aspect for ourselves. And I am very pleased in this time frame, more and more people are speaking and addressing this factor, no matter what a person's age might be. And I think that this is very, very significant, and it went a long way to helping you actually cope as you were detoxifying yourself. Am I correct?
Yes, our nutrition, I hate to say this, but is definitely been rearranged not to be in nutritional benefit to our bodies. The GMO foods are genetically manufactured to release any nutritional value. So I very purposely at the store make sure I try to buy organic and non-GMO, because if the seed has been removed from the God source in that seed that would make it grow into a nutritional item for our benefit in eating. So not only is the GMO food causing us to not have the nutritional value so we can... Pardon me just a minute, I need to clear my throat. The GMO stops the nutritional value so we can think rationally. And also in my book, I talk about natural flavors and artificial flavors. You can hardly buy an item on the shelf today that doesn't have natural or artificial flavors. Sadly, the FDA has allowed manufacturers to add elements into our food, and they don't have to disclaim what it is. And often it's like adding an addict, like in Kentucky Fried Chicken, the MSG is addictive. So the elements they're adding to our foods are bringing on weight for people in one way. They're also causing people to, because it tastes so good, I want more. So then you become compulsive in your eating and whatever items that they've added it to that adds that artificial chemical to your system, and you're starting to eat more. And so, you know, it gets out of control, and that's called addiction. So the artificial and they call it natural, but they are not natural. They're made in a chemistry lab to not, it doesn't benefit your health, let's put it that way. In the front part of the book, part one, I talk about how this plan is depopulation. And as the population is depleting in the various ways I explain in the book of how they're depleting the population, our food is just one. In other books, I've talked about how the air is being polluted by chemtrails and all the different ways that they're trying to, in medicine, the toxic medicines that we have and so forth. The behind the agenda is to depopulate the population for a smaller population to control. And I explain that quite a bit more in the first part of the book of how that came about and the history of it.
When you were putting this book together, you really wanted people to be able to look at a number of different aspects, a number of facts, so that they could begin to question or ask questions, to be curious, to be thinking about themselves. And this, I feel, is something that in society, and this could be at any part of the world, we all have those paradigms that are introduced to us in our indoctrinations of one kind or another. And to be able to recognize ourselves as individuals and realize we're also part of a massive collective, if you will, called human beings, and that we do have a significant role in life, and we do have a significant purpose in life. We may not have yet discovered it, but just like with you, you find through your writing and through the disciplines that you learned in getting advanced education, how important it is to be a critical thinker, to ask questions. This is something that I feel took me a long time, because it was exactly the opposite of what I was taught. It was okay to ask questions and not to be intimidated when people would say, well, I think what you're asking is stupid, or, you know, by the remarks that they would retort with. It's fascinating how we have to learn how to be able to be comfortable in our own skin. And as we have already shared, it took you quite a few years to be able to recognize that you can be totally at peace within yourself and have a constructive conversation with someone and really not care whether they agree with you or disagree with you.
Well, it's taken a lot of years in understanding to grow into that, be able to handle what you just said. One of the chapters is about education, and I'm a retired teacher. And I'm just very sad about how education has really changed into making rubber stamps of students that they all think in that box that you talked about. And that so people aren't supposed to question authority. They're not supposed to question experts. When I taught school, there were just very few tests of children to see what their individual progress was. Nowadays, the children have tests every year to make sure they have learned the dogma or the propaganda, to make sure that they are nice, good little followers, nice, good little soldiers, you might say. And like you said, not to think for themselves. And so my religion did the same thing to me. You think from the church dogma rather than from your heart. And in binding meditation, I've learned to move out of my head for my answers or to other people and move into my heart, where the answers for me are there for my life path, not what somebody tells me I have to. You know, a lot of people, there were actually 5 multimillionaires I saw this article on the internet years back, who never graduated from high school but became multimillionaires. You don't have to go to college. You don't have to go through the routine of what the culture tells us to have a successful life. It comes from within, and it manifests into your life. When you're out of your head, that actually stops your life. So when you're coming from your heart and the love within, it blossoms, it blooms, and opportunities show up. And when life gets difficult, it's just another opportunity to choose. This is a planet of choice, and we can choose to resist the new lesson in our life, to pick a loving resolution for the situation, or we can stay in fear and anger and never grow. So as we are learning to think for ourselves, we'll say, I had a stroke a year and a half ago, and in the ambulance heading for Tacoma General Hospital, I cried out inside of my head, God, what's the lesson in this one? And we think for ourselves, and we don't have to buy into what we've been told.
Mm-hmm. I think that that is extraordinarily important. And it does take time for us to really understand the law of attraction, which is what you discuss in your book. And the section on education, I think, is very, very important, because our children need to know that the world that they will create for themselves, they don't create my world, they're going to create their world. When
right, it's all for the benefit of the elite or the rich, whatever title you want to give them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, it takes courage, and it always has taken courage throughout history, to be able to stand in one's own space and say, I am who I am, and I love and respect myself. That's very powerful. That is extraordinarily powerful. And when that happens, other people want to know how you do it, and it's really not anything super colossal complicated, but it is that understanding you can respect yourself, you can appreciate the lessons that you've gone through, take the gold nugget out of the lesson, and get rid of the garbage.
Well, you know, I was so codependent. I was still so dependent on my parents because, you know, they couldn't raise me from their not being raised themselves. And so I had no clue of how to live life. And you know, that continued with me throughout life. But I found out as I got into recovery, there isn't anything that I can do on my own. I need God. I need a higher power. I need that loving energy that gives me the courage and the faith. And I say, God, I need more faith for this one. Here we go again. And each time we grow into being more mature, if we stay in the fear, I'm finding out, that's like a little child in the dark bedroom at night, and he's scared, and he says, Mommy, there's a boogeyman in my room. And Mommy comes and turns on the light and shows him there's no boogeyman. And that's what we're doing with our life. We call on the light of our Creator to turn on the light. There's no boogeyman. There's no fear. We can go ahead and just see that everything is okay. And today I see through the eyes of love. I don't see through the eyes of fear, but there's no boogeyman.
Mm-hmm. And that is a huge accomplishment. That really is a huge accomplishment. And Marilyn, that's one of the gifts that you want people to get from this book. And there's many other gifts that you give in the awareness and the knowledge and research that you have in your book, A Spark of Truth. You also have a blog, and you've got how many other publications? You've got ebooks, and what else have you got?
Well, I have a total of, including A Spark of Truth, I have 11 books, and some of them are ebooks, and they're all on Amazon. And I write two columns a month. One is an international column for Sussex newspaper. Every month I put out a column, have for several years. And I also have a local newspaper I write for and have a column. My blog with my books is Marilyn Redmond Books. blogspot.com. I have 190 videos on YouTube if people want to check that out. And my books, of course, are at Amazon, and my website is angelicasgifts.com. And so I try to keep everything up to date. So my writing is usually currently continually changing with new understandings that I come into. So it's not the same old story. It's the current things that I've just recently learned and grown from. So hopefully the readers will grow with me.
Well, I think your book, A Spark of Truth, is just so informative and has so much information and detail. And again, you go into more depth relative to your own personal story and the aspects that you had to break through relative to barriers, etc. So A Spark of Truth, and it's Marilyn Redman. Actually, they show Reverend Marilyn L. Redman. And the website is AngelicasGifts.com. And that's AngelicasGifts.com. Marilyn, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so much for being with me.
Well, thank you for allowing me to share, you know, that people can find a new way to life that is going to give them happy, joyous, and a peaceful way of life that they deserve.
My pleasure. Donna Sebo here. We are taking a break. I am in studio, so you'll be able to give me a call, 253-582-5597. We'll be right back. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, we only have one more evening show in this last program of 2023, and it's going to be an open mic hour. So tomorrow evening, if you wanted to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Remember, between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific time, that phone line, just as it's going to be in just a moment, it's going to be open where you can call in and chat with me, and I'd be delighted again to light up your life with a little bit of insight. And I will only need your first name or your initial, but give me a buzz if you'd like to chat tomorrow evening, the last evening show of 2023. So we are then heading in to, yes, Happy New Year and New Year's Day, which is the 1st of January on Monday. I am going to be enjoying that as a day to celebrate the new year along with all the rest of you. So pre-recorded programming will be in place for that day. And then we're going to, on January 2nd, be talking with George Calderisi. We're going to be talking about battleship writers, how they're sharing their secrets. So if this is one of your goals to write a book and to publish it, this is, I think, a fabulous way to be introduced into an environment with some professionals that have enjoyed a level of success with their writing and their tips and suggestions. Then we're going to be talking with Jerry Cantor about the emotional roots of chronic illness. And also we'll be talking with Grant Menzies about Freddie. Now, we're going to be going to Canada for that conversation. Freddie is a rescue dog. Oh my goodness, the cover of the book has the image of Freddie, and it is precious. And then we're going to be talking about Whole Heart for Girls, Whole Heart for Boys, and Whole Heart for Women with Dr. Amy Stark. She is wonderful. She has been working with so many people through the years, and she has come up with these wonderful publications that are just a great way to start off the year. And for having the one with children, we're going to be addressing all three of those publications, but the one for children, specifically for the girls, and one specifically for the boys. Wow, what a difference that makes. And also, Well, cranky soup. We are having a few technical problems this evening, so we are just going to keep moving right along. And we have got, like I said, we are going to be having a number of guests, and we will be putting that in the newsletter that is going to be coming out on the first of the month. So I wanted to be sure that you were made aware of that. And we're going to keep on going. The phone number to call in to the program is 253-582-5597. Well, there's all kinds of traditions that have been reinforced when it comes to dress codes, but have you ladies ever noticed, and you guys probably are aware of this, it may not be so important today, but there were protocols when it came to being well-dressed. And, of course, this goes by a number of different levels, depending on what societal environment that you are in and what the occasion might be. Well, the modern three-piece suit for men and wearing that type of a legacy is actually due to British royalty. Mm-hmm. And it came about from 1666. Who was the person that made this mandatory? And of course, you know, that's a jacket and a vest in our modern world, and slacks. Well, not too many men wear a vest anymore, but it is something that the proper attire when you are in a formal dress, that's something that's very acceptable. Well, they were encouraged to dress with a vest because it was supposed to teach the nobility thrift. And this is according to a man whose name was Samuel Pepys. He said they really probably wanted to use a vest because it enabled you to be sleeveless if you wanted to be. But the vest was buttoned up the front, and it was buttoned from top to bottom until the beginning of the 19th century, when the king-to-be was the Prince of Wales. Now, he was a bit portly in his build, and the Prince of Mail of Wales, he had a very dear friend, Beau Brummel. Now, Beau Brummel was known in the fashion world for men. He was the one that set the standard for stylish elegance for men. He got rid of the bows and the weird-looking shoes that so often were promoted by the French. Were very extravagant. And in my view, in today's world, I look at it and I go, how in the world did the men handle it? Because usually in our world, the guys use a lot less stress in getting dressed and appearing very nicely in their outfits. But we women seem to still carry on a lot of, what do I want to say, excessiveness with clothes, but that is something that I really think many of us enjoy to a degree. Well, Beau Brummel was slim and trim, and he set the tone for British polite society. And, of course, when one has girth of form rather than any sense of style, what did you do? You would unbutton the final button on vests and jackets alike. And if you look at even some of the James Bond movies, when they get up, he's got his suit on. He always buttons the top button, but never does the bottom button on a jacket. That's just style. And it's because Prince of Wales in England could not close his bottom button that men of fashion, well, they leave theirs open today. So that's a little bit of something. And handkerchiefs. Oh, my goodness. Once Kleenex was invented, handkerchiefs went by the wayside big time. But what do we do? With men, they'll stuff it in their pocket. And I know that I've used a handkerchief to decorate a pocket with suits when I've worn them and certain outfits that have those pockets, even with a casual shirt. And it really looks very, very nice. Well, handkerchiefs were used because they didn't have Kleenex like we have today. And, of course, they got to be pretty messy after a while. You know, you see the old BBC programmings where they show how the men had these gigantic handkerchiefs that they would pull out of their pockets. Well, it became fashionable to evolve to putting them in the chest pocket. And it really does make a very attractive look for men as well as women. But the pocket handkerchief today is usually used for show, as someone said, but not for blow. I remember as a little girl that was something we were supposed to have. And when I was a little girl, the handkerchiefs were just gorgeous. And I remember seeing the most beautifully embroidered handkerchiefs that you would carry just to have them handy in case you didn't get to a handkerchief. And they were so pretty, you didn't even want to ever use them. But you would use them perhaps for decoration with an outfit. Or if you were traveling and you were going into, let's say, a church where they wanted to have the women cover their heads, you could put that handkerchief on your head as a hair covering. So, you know, it's just little bits, tidbits of history. We wonder why we do certain things or why we dress a certain way. And it's all because of something that was done a long time ago that we have adapted to today's world. Well, 253-582-5597, if you would like to chat. Years ago, a very dear friend of mine, whenever she had company, she would always fix something very, very special. Especially if it was going to be for a breakfast or a very, very casual but flavorful dinner. And it was a recipe for stuffed French toast. Well, I had never, ever had stuffed French toast. And my friend Gail, she said, oh, it's so good. Well, as it turned out, I hadn't even thought about that for such a long time. But that was one of my friend's favorite recipes to share with other people. And as it turned out, I got something in the mail relative to stuffed French toast. And it was developed by an individual whose initials are M-A-J. And she said that this was served to their family for brunch, and it was always a big hit. And she said it was easier to assemble than she had ever thought. And the filling that you would have for the stuffed French toast would keep the bread slices together. And you would actually end up having like three layers of bread in the egg mix. You put it all together and you bake it. You're not frying it on top of the stove. And she said you're going to use a lot less butter. And it's not as messy as frying French toast, you know, if you have it stuffed like this. And she said she used one mashed banana in half of the filling and one cup of sliced fresh strawberries in the other half. And she said it was just delicious. People loved it. So I said, okay, I'm going to share this with you because it is something that's different. And, you know, for New Year's Day, maybe you're having a crowd over to your house and you're saying, what can I fix? It would be really, really easy, but very, very different. Well, let me share this with you. And of course, remember, with any recipe, you can always adapt it any way that you like. Well, what you're going to need is 16 ounces, two packages of cream cheese. You want it at room temperature. You need a half a cup of sour cream. You can use plain yogurt if you want, unsweetened. And you need 2 tablespoons of sugar, 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract. And she used 2 ripe bananas. She mashed them. Or you can use fresh strawberries. Or you can use raspberry or strawberry preserves, whatever is your pleasure. And she used raisin bread. So you can get your raisin bread. It's already sliced and ready to go. So the French toast mixture that you're going to use is 1 1/4 cups of milk, 8 eggs, 2 tablespoons of confectionery sugar, and you might want a little bit more to dust it just to give it a little bit of a decoration. 1 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and of course you want to have maple syrup when it's time to munch and just savor this very, very delicious stuffed French toast. Now, your oven needs to be 350 degrees, and you need a 15 by 10 by 1 inch baking sheet. And you could use parchment paper if you want, but if you're going to put it right in the pan so that it goes into the oven, then I would say use nonstick cooking spray to make sure that it's easy to get out and off of the pan. So your filling, you're just going to combine with a mixer, your cream cheese, your sour cream, sugar, cinnamon, vanilla, and bananas. And then you're going to spread the filling evenly on one bread slice, then top it with another slice, spread the filling evenly on the second slice, and top it with the third slice. And you repeat with the remaining filling and bread. Just make up a batch. It makes 8 servings, this recipe, by the way. Now, for your French toast, you're going to take your milk, your eggs, your confectionery sugar, your cinnamon and vanilla, and you're going to blend that thoroughly. Your egg mixture, you're going to put into a shallow bowl, and you want to dip your prepared bread layers into the mixture, turning to coat both sides of that stack evenly. Then you place it on your prepared baking sheet. You bake it for 8 to 10 minutes at 350 degrees. Flip it over and bake for 8 to 10 minutes or more until it's golden brown. And then if you like, you can dust it lightly with additional confectionery sugar if you so desire. And then serve that with warm maple syrup. And it might be fun to just try something instead of a plain yogurt. If you wanted that extra vanilla flavor punch, you might want to use vanilla-flavored yogurt. Now, I said unsweetened because you're already going to be adding some sugar, but if you like things sweeter, that might be something else to try. And it's just something that's really, really tasty and flavorful and different. And it might be something that could become a family or a guest favorite, however you want to do it. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Remember, tomorrow evening, I am going to be available to do readings for anyone that would like to call in at the studio between 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific time. You may or may not have ever wondered where our alphabet came from, and there is so much we don't know when it comes to history. And of course, archaeologists just really relish an idea of being out on a site and discovering something that is relevant to human history. And we now know that humans have been on this planet for thousands of years, and we're really becoming quite amazed at what we are finding is relative to current conditions in many respects, and even with climate change. We've found that it's not something unusual relative to this planet itself. Well, when it comes to our alphabet, there was a discovery in June of 2016. There was a Canaanite city of Lachish led by a gentleman, by the archaeologist Yosef Garfinkel. He's associated with the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and Michael Hassall of Southern Advent University. And they found something which had been misidentified and by previous researchers. They thought it was a small bone. However, when they were checking it out, there was a man, Edward Mayer. He is a zoo archaeologist. He said, "I think this is an ivory comb. I think most of the teeth have broken off, but I do think it was a comb." And they said, "Okay, let's really see what we can find out." And they found that on this comb, there actually were fossilized lice. Yes, this was used to get lice out of the hair. They had a problem with that, just like we do in modern days. And they said, this is a comb to use on the hair. And it wasn't very big. and it was made of ivory. So they said since there were no elephants in Canaan, they knew that it had to be imported from somewhere. But there was an archaeologist, her name was Madeline Mokuiglu, and she, upon examining it, said, well, I found something that is a surprise. There's actually letters on this, or we'll say characters, as they would call it. And there was an epigraphist, Daniel Weinstub, who worked at Israel's Ben-Gurion University. He was able to translate it. After she found these carvings that were in the ivory, and he said, this reads, may this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard. Oh, that must have been very enlightening. They think it came from the time period of 1700 BC, and they say this is perhaps the oldest known complete sentence discovered to date, written in a Canaanite script. And they've only found bits and pieces of the script from a previous period. And they said, you know, we can't really give you an exact date on the age of the comb. It's just so very, very old, and being of the material that it is, it's very difficult for us to give you an absolute. But they said the Canaanite writing system itself, to date, they feel it emerged between 1900 and 1400 BC, and it really assisted when it came to having communication between people. And they said there was a very simple association between a character and a specific sound. And they feel that this writing that's on this comb proves the basis that those of us in the Western environment working with our alphabets, that's how it began. It began as far back as that period. And they said, finding a complete Canaanite sentence is one of the most important discoveries made in recent years. It is a landmark in being able to understand the evolution of the alphabet that we use today. Ah, history. We always end up finding some of the most unusual and interesting aspects that we would not ever imagine existed. I think that's exciting. I really do. There is so much that we don't know, and every once in a while we are going to find out about that that educates us in a very, very special way. There is so much out there in the world that we have a chance to really recognize that there's never a lack of opportunity for innovation. And when you think of the amount of patents that are filed every year, thousands of them from around the world, people are always trying to see a better way of being able to accomplish and do whatever needs to be done. And there is a woman by the name of Barbara McClintock. She was a pioneering geneticist, and we don't hear much about women and their inventions. I remember when I first found out about Hedy Lamarr and how, because of her, we were able to evolve into the cell phone and development of same because of what she knew. The woman, though she was a lovely woman in the acting world, she was a brilliant woman. She was a genius. And she came up with so many different things. And in the world that she existed in at that time, women were just supposed to look pretty and forget it, the fact that you had a brain. You weren't supposed to use it. That was just only male environment and territory. Well, we're finding out that in many, many respects, there were women working behind the scenes and developing things. And one of these women in history is actually a Nobel laureate's recognition of her. Her name is Barbara McClintock. And as I said, she was a pioneering geneticist, but she worked with corn. That's right. Corn, which for many peoples was the staff of life. And she is, to date, the only woman to win an unshared prize in physiology or medicine. Yes, she actually earned the Nobel Prize in 1983. She discovered what's called transposable elements or jumping genes. You know, genetics are so important, but genetics are not static. They do jump, and that they can also be rearranged. And that is at the core of what today scientists are working with. If they discover a gene that can possibly create a serious health problem, they're developing the sophisticated technology where if this is discovered, for example, in an embryo, then they will be able to remove that. And, you know, if there's always kinds of concerns about genetic modification, but this is something that could make a big difference in life in a huge way. Now, she was born in 1902, and she began her work on corn in graduate school, and then, of course, with the Second World War, and she was studying in Germany. The German scientists were way ahead of, you might say, the United States. In fact, a lot of scientists in the U.S. would go to Germany to study because they were so far ahead in much of the research that we were still not very, very much advanced in. And then they would come back to the United States and they would share whatever they had learned. Now, the segments of DNA that can change position, well, that is something that really has made a difference because it is a way of working with viruses and bacteria and the human genome. And she was one of the first women elected to the National Academy of Sciences and became the first woman president of the Genetics Society of America. And in 1981, she was one of the first people to receive the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grant. And she said, you know, it never occurred to me that this was, you know, that there was going to be any kind of stumbling block. Not that she said she had any aspirations to do anything spectacular to affect the world. She said she just loved her work. When you have the joy, you do the right experiments, you let the material tell you where to go, and it tells you at every step what the next step has to be. That reminded me so much of George Washington Carver. This is that man, he would say, if you just pay attention to nature and you listen carefully, you are going to find what the plant has to share with you and what you can do with it. And he went on to invent from the humble peanut. He went on to produce all kinds of products. Because he said there's options to work with. And I think of him on so many different occasions when people will talk about creating new products, new ways of doing things. He did that. George Washington Carver did. And so did Ms. McClintock. Barbara McClintock, she absolutely, for many, many years, dedicated herself to one food product, and that was corn. And she was able to make the invisible visible. And she said, that's what science is all about. Science is about stepping into new territories and finding out what we need to find out so that we can move forward in a whole new way that can benefit on so many different levels. That, I think, is a great way to look at this coming year. We are going to be doing so many great things on so many different levels, and we all have the opportunity to expand ourselves in an absolutely phenomenal and magnificent way. Donna Sebo here. I'm sorry for the technical problems that we've had, but hey, we'll work through those. It's not the end of the world. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We'll be talking again soon. Bye for now.
been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.